Some of the most effective treatments in psychiatry are also the most underutilized: lithium, clozapine, ECT. But should we add disulfiram for alcohol use disorders to that list? Welcome to the Carlyle Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlyle Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric NP and a dedicated reader of every issue. Every week, we open this podcast with that same intro, that we've been keeping psychiatry honest since 2003. That is when the first issue of the Carlyle Report came out. But it's not the only Carlyle journal out there. We also have an edition for Child Psychiatry, launched in 2010, Addiction Psychiatry, 2013, Hospital Psychiatry, released this year in 2021, and we're planning a geriatric edition for 2022. But the Carlyle Report that Dr. Aiken edits is for general psychiatry, or all things psychiatric, as the byline says. But when something from the more specialized arms that the general psychiatrist needs catches our eye, we try to include it. And that's what happened this month with disulfiram, a medication for alcohol use disorders that is also known by its catchy trade name as antabuse.
Disulfiram works through an unusual mechanism. It prevents the liver from clearing out acetaldehyde, the metabolite of alcohol that is responsible for the hangover effect, as well as for a lot of the health risks with alcohol, like heart disease. When patients who are taking disulfiram drink even a sip of alcohol, they can become violently ill with nausea, vomiting, malaise, and headaches. In my training, I was taught that disulfiram was not very effective because, you know, patients would just stop taking it if they wanted to drink. So I was surprised last winter when I came across a new meta-analysis of medications for alcoholism in patients with comorbid depression. The study looked at 18 classes of medications, and only three of them stood out with a statistically significant effect. They were the anticonvulsants, specifically carbamazepine, topiramate, Topamax, and tiagabin, gabitril. Also, a combination of naltrexone with a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, baclofen, and finally, disulfiram antabuse. These network meta-analyses are fairly conservative in their algorithms, so it's not surprising that only a small handful came up as effective. But what did surprise me is that disulfiram's effect size was much higher than the other medications, and it was the only medication that came up positive for all the outcome measures, both remission from alcohol use and the number of days abstinent from alcohol use. I realized I had been underestimating disulfiram's utility, so I called up one of our writers who is also an addiction psychiatrist, Stephen Wyatt, and he straightened me out on a few things. Disulfiram does work well, and not just in depressed patients. It often outperforms other medications in general alcohol use disorders. And it is certainly true that patients can stop the medication if they get the urge to drink, but satisfying that urge is not so simple because they need to wait 2 weeks after stopping it for the disulfiram interaction to clear out. And I was not the only physician who was underutilizing disulfiram. Apparently, this is a national problem. Some avoid it because they think it doesn't work, and others because they think it is too dangerous. There's a myth out there that patients will drink impulsively on it and die from the interaction. This has to do with a misunderstanding about disulfiram when it was first released back in the 1950s. Back then, doctors thought that it worked through aversive conditioning. That is, that patients needed to experience the disulfiram hangover in order to overcome their alcoholism. Within a year of that kind of use, though, the first deaths on the medication started to emerge. And since then, you start disulfiram by recommending that patients never drink on it. With that sensible warning in place, deaths have been exceedingly rare on disulfiram in the past few decades. Another thing that's changed is that physicians have found out low doses are just as effective as the high doses they used to use, and a lot safer. But most importantly, Dr. Wyatt set me straight on this. Deaths from alcohol-related problems, from falls to liver toxicity to car accidents, are through the roof in the USA. Among Gen Xers, alcohol-related problems are the number one cause of death, and for the country as a whole, it's the third leading cause of preventable deaths. So that got me thinking about avoiding disulfiram in order to prevent deaths. No self-respecting oncologist would withhold chemotherapy because the chemotherapeutic agents are potentially lethal. Cancer is a far more lethal disease than chemotherapy, and alcohol use disorders are far more lethal than any of the treatments we have for them, disulfiram included.
Yeah, but our culture doesn't view alcoholism the way they view cancer. Alcohol use disorders are still seen as something that the patient does to themselves, while cancer is a disease that happens to them. That's just stigma, plain and simple. But I can see how that stigma rubs off on our prescribing practices. We don't want to be responsible for bad outcomes when we're treating something that much of the world doesn't even view as a legitimate disease.
There are a lot more myths and surprises about disulfiram, so check out our June-July issue for more. In this companion podcast, we're going to delve into the history of this unusual medication. Disulfiram is the oldest psychiatric medication still in use. It even predates lithium, which was first tested in bipolar disorder in Australia in 1949. Disulfiram, though, began its clinical journey a few years before that, and it received FDA approval for alcohol use disorders in 1951. But we might never have discovered disulfiram if it weren't for the automobile industry and the tires it requires.
Charles Goodyear had an obsession. The Connecticut inventor wanted to find a way to stabilize rubber. In the 1800s, rubber was harvested from tree sap in the Amazon rainforest. Its elastic nature held great potential, but rubber had a serious flaw. It cracked in the winter and melted in the summer. Charles spent 5 years and his family's fortune trying to create a more resilient rubber, until a fateful day in 1839 when he accidentally dropped some rubber and sulfur on a hot stove. The combination of heat and sulfur transformed the material into a charred mass that most people would have thrown away. But Charles saw what he was looking for, a stronger rubber that held up well under extremes of temperatures. He called it vulcanized rubber, after the Roman god of fire. Goodyear set up a rubber factory in Naugatuck, Connecticut, a town just north of New Haven that soon became the rubber capital of the world. And the rubber he produced helped turn the wheels of the Industrial Revolution and later forged the tires that bear his name on many automobiles. The factories that built the Industrial Age depended on vulcanized rubber. It shaped the valves, belts, and bands that turned the factory wheels and it sealed the steam engines that powered them. But another chemical was getting in the way of that revolution. Alcohol. Before the Industrial Revolution, most Americans drank alcohol regularly, day and night. It flowed in the halls of Congress and was a normal part of the workplace. Some people took it too far, but they were largely seen as a danger to themselves and pitied as the town drunk. But with the rise of factories, that danger spread to the community. The factory could not run when essential workers stayed home with a hangover. And if they came into work intoxicated, it was far worse. Factory accidents could be deadly, and accidents were increasingly blamed on the excessive drinking that was woven into early American life. But factory life was stressful, and the saloon was a popular spot for workers to let off the steam of industrial life. And the ensuing intoxication wasn't just causing problems at work, it was damaging their family lives as well. Soon, a loose coalition began to form among the wives of the heavy drinkers, the industrial leaders who depended on them, and the churches where they worshipped. This temperance movement gained political steam between 1860 and 1920, culminating in the legal prohibition of alcohol in America, Canada, and Scandinavia during the otherwise roaring 20s.
Legal prohibition of alcohol did not work, and most of those countries put an end to the experiment in the 1930s after about a decade of enforced abstinence. But another discovery was just around the corner that would pave the way to a chemically induced enforced abstinence, and it took place in a rubber factory in Naugatuck, Connecticut, the same town where Charles Goodyear had first vulcanized rubber 100 years before.
E.E. Williams was an industrial physician who worked for the rubber industry and looked after the health of their employees. In 1937, he noticed something unusual. Factory workers were becoming very ill with flushing, racing heart, nausea, vomiting, and headaches after drinking alcohol. Williams traced the problem to a new chemical in the vulcanization process. They had replaced the sulfur in Goodyear's original formula with disulfiram. When disulfiram made its way to the worker's liver, it blocked the enzyme that clears out acetaldehyde, a metabolite of alcohol that is responsible for the hangover effect. Dr. Williams noted that many of his patients gave up alcohol completely after experiencing this reaction, and speculated that disulfiram might be used as a kind of aversive cure for alcoholism. Clinical trials of disulfiram ensued, and in 1951, the FDA approved the medication for alcohol use disorders. But disulfiram may go back even further. The Irish psychiatrist Seamus P.M. McCibine has discovered evidence of a disulfiram-like reaction that early herbalists recognized as a cure for alcoholism. It's kind of disgusting, so bear with me. When eels die in wine, they produce a substance similar to disulfiram that also inhibits the breakdown of alcohol's metabolite, producing aversive hangovers. This reaction was noted in a medical text from 600 AD, which said, quote, "When eels are killed in wine, whoever drinks it then develops a distaste for wine." The same therapeutic advice showed up in a manual of medical herbs from the 1600s. Eels, being put into wine or beer, and suffer to die in it, he that drinks it will never endure that sort of liquor again.
I've been wondering why anybody drank wine after soaking eels in it. My best guess is that eels marinated in wine was a short-lived delicacy back then. You can learn more about how to use disulfiram in our online edition. But now, for the word of the day, the serotonin transporter gene.
SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, work by, while as the name implies, blocking the reuptake of serotonin into the neuron. And the gate where they block that reentry is the serotonin transporter, also known as SERT, S-E-R-T, or 5-HTT. And you need to know all three of those names because they are often interchanged. There's another word you need to know on this subject as well, the SLC6A4 gene, which is a gene that codes for the serotonin transporter. The SLC6A4 gene is one of the most popular genes on pharmacogenetic test panels because it purports to tell us whether a depressed patient will respond to an SSRI or not. But that data is old news. It showed promise 10 years ago and has since failed to hold up its end of the hypothesis in study after study, although it has a small influence in some populations like older Caucasian males. The serotonin transporter did not evolve to receive SSRIs, however. And in next week's podcast, we'll explore how the SERT gene, S-E-R-T, influences everything from viral illness to personality in an interview with Vladimir Melotek.
You can read the full articles and earn CME credits at thecarlattreport.com, where we have a special offer for our podcast listeners. You can get $30 off your first year's subscription with the promo code PODCAST in all caps.
The Carlatt Report is one of the few CME publications that depends entirely on subscribers. Thank you for helping us stay free of commercial support.